Excision number 11512, reel 5.
Major Watson, reel 5.
If Tripoli were not taken soon, then the van of the 8th Army, of which we were, the whole of that forward part of the 8th Army would have to be withdrawn back to Benghazi because the supply lines were so extended, and Tripoli, of course, would give a new port available for the landing of stores, etc. So Kharadini, however untidy and however unpleasant, was an absolute must and was taken in time. We then moved on to Wadi Zambra and Janima. We stopped outside Janima and Tripoli was taken in February. There was no fighting in Tripoli as such that I'm aware of. We were camped outside Tripoli in an olive grove, which was very pleasant. And some of us, the smarter, or those with decent khaki drill, etc., were chosen to take part in a victory parade in Tripoli, which was, of course, attended by Monty, and I think Churchill came there. I, being not one of the smart ones, etc., that wasn't on the parade, but it was quite an impressive parade, and there are photographs showing the parade taking place in Tripoli. From Tripoli, ultimately, we moved into the or towards the Marath line. The Marath line was more or less the dividing line between Tripolitania and Tunisia. Tunisia then being under French suzerainty. And they had built the Marath line against the possibility that the Italians, who then overruled Tripoli, might invade, or at least to protect Tunisia. A particularly strong line, and we were now getting into an area of not flat country, but of the most remarkable sandstone mountains, to which we give various names. After being so long in the flat, to see these huge mountains in the distance rearing up was an incredible sight. I remember one was called Top Hat because of its shape. And it was in the foothills, I suppose, of these mountains that the Marath line had been built. An extremely strong line. And we were in front of the Marath line, I suppose, for about a week or 10 days. I think this is the occasion, or it may have been prior to this, that a friend, Ken Gillis, had been sent forward off our front positions, well into no man's land, the distance of, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles, with a small composite force. I think he had a brain gun carrier with him, an artillery piece, and himself and 9 or 10 jocks, to be in a position to observe, because the country here was still very flat, and there was no marked front line, and the Germans were some distance away, and his task was to observe and report back. And the CO and I went out one day to liaise with Ken. And the CO decided, Ken had taken a position slightly on the reverse slope of a small mound in the ground. The CO decided we should go forward and have a look and see what the country was like in front. So we went onto the forward slope and walked part of the way down. And all of a sudden, there were three cracks and three mortar shells landed around us, and one of them killed Ken. It was most remarkable. There was no, well, you don't expect a preamble, but there was no stonk afterwards. Nothing happened. Three mortar shells. We obviously got down, and when they stopped, the CEO and I got up, no Ken. So we found his body, and I tried to drag him back, but far too heavy dragging. So the CEO went back to get his jeep, and I said, right, I'll take a compass bearing of where the body is, and we can go over and pick his body up. So I took a compass bearing. But the incredible thing about Ken, though, was, although he was a minister's son, he had a passion for small arms, revolvers and things. And he had on his person a German Luger, an Italian Beretta, and two other revolvers. When I took these from his tunic and put them in mine, because being a clerk, when I took the compass bearing, I'd forgotten to lay off for that amount of metal I was carrying, because obviously that affects the bearing you take with a prismatic compass. So when we went back on a compass bearing, we obviously went the wrong way, and it took us some time to find Ken's body. No more mortar found, nothing. Incredible situation. So we got Ken back, and then the CEO went off, and I was left in charge of this forward position. And what must have happened in many places in the desert and other war areas, we buried Ken there, myself and the jocks, in a blanket, put him in the ground. It was pretty hard ground, we couldn't get him down very hard. And his burial service was the Lord's Prayer. What else could a bloke do? Isn't it funny? But at least he was buried. And just as we finished, a German Messerschmitt came roaring out of the sky. So we jumped for cover, and the only casualty we had was a wee dog. Where that dog came from, no one knows. That one of the jocks had befriended was nicked in the leg by one of the machine gun bullets from the Messerschmitt aircraft. Most incredible situation, but then typical of the very odd situations that must have happened in a war as fluid, as widespread over a vast flat area, as was fighting in the desert. I don't know if you want me to come on. The Marath line, again, was a very difficult situation. I haven't mentioned, of course, in all this meandering, the patrolling that we had to do. One of my jobs was to do a lot of reconnaissance patrolling, and also other officers in the battalion had to become involved in reconnaissance patrols. And the idea was that you went out at night with no shining parts of your equipment showing, of course. That was obviously camouflage, the glint in the moonlight or whatever. Nothing on you that rattled, only your identity disc and your map if it was necessary, certainly compass, and your rifle. You might on occasions trail behind you a signal telephone wire, so that if you were going to be in a forward position, i.e. an observation post, you could relay back to the battalion what you were seeing or what you'd learned. But patrolling was an astonishing feeling, going out into no man's land, you and two or three men creeping cautiously forward, well, upright, you didn't creep, with the or the desert shoes on, which were patrol boots, which became known as brothel keepers, creepers. They were kind of suede boots with rubber soles. They made very little sound on the desert. And you would go out, bright moonlight night, feeling a bit naked, to see how far you could get before you came across any enemy positions, so that the depth of no man's land and the plotting of the enemy positions could be appreciated, feeling somewhat naked. But doing it, this is the astonishing thing, you did it, you went out and you did it. And I remember one occasion, there was a wog or a native straw hut slightly to our right. And you clearly couldn't pass this without looking at it to see if anything or anybody was in it. So you diverted off your compass bearing and you went to see. Afterwards, you realize anything could have happened. There might have been somebody in it. Somebody might have shot at you or something like that. But you did it because it was part of the job. It was part of your function to do things like that. And patrolling, it was a strange experience. And of course, when you went out through your own lines and you came back, you had to have a password to come back, and you had to be able to come back precisely where you went out. Otherwise, you were going into some part of the line where people didn't know you were out there. And it was all right if you were patrolling to the north, as we were once we got round the Gulf of Sirte. Because you had the North Star, and it's constant. It doesn't vary. You can just go on the North Star, and that's it. But, of course, in any other place, you had to take a bearing. You worked out on the map what your bearing was going to be. So you would choose a star. But you could only walk on that star for, I think it was 15 minutes or half an hour. And then you had to recheck your bearing and get onto another star. Because you couldn't, obviously, go on a looking at your compass all the time, because you would see nothing and you would appreciate nothing of the kind of ground you were going over. So patrolling really became a kind of an art in some ways, and there were fighting patrols and reconnaissance patrols. Fighting patrols were nasty bits of work, but it's a digression really to talk about them, because the aim was to get into an enemy position and bring back prisoners. But the so a lot of patrolling was done in all parts of the desert, and also before the Marath line. I remember in particular an attack made by a 50 Division, who were on our right on the Marath line, the Jardis. And they really got churned up. It was a terrible position they had to attack. It really was the difficulty of terrain, the exposure as they went forward, the strength of the blockhouses, the strength of the gun positions. And I think that was all over what was known as Wadi Zigzag. I think they had to cross a wadi first too, which is a small valley. An incredible attack they made, but they really had enormous casualties. Eventually, I forget how the Marath line was breached, to be quite honest, and I forget our part in it. Isn't that strange? Medinine, I remember. The dominance of Medinin, the German gun positions. But after Marath, I can't even remember what happened at Marist, but our next engagement was at a place called Wadi Akarit. We passed through the delightful little French or Tunisian town of Gabis, and just north of Gabis, if my geography doesn't fault me now, was Wadi Akarit. And this was really the last major defended German position. I think that they held. The Wadi was a very big valley at the end of a long flat plain dominated by mountains. I think the Jebel Ramana was one of the mountains. And it was the task of the Highland Division to breach the wadi, which had been made into an anti-tank ditch by making the sides more sloped, making it more difficult for tanks to get over, to clear the minefield on the other side and the barbed wire defences, and to make a bridgehead on the other side of the wadi so that the New Zealand Division could go through us to chase the Germans out of Tunisia. The battle itself took place on the 6th of April 1943. The night prior to the battle, we had taken up our pre-attack positions at night, and this brings home again one of the experiences one recalls. We couldn't, because it was going to be a daylight attack on this occasion, we couldn't take any blankets, etc., with us to the pre-assault area. So we just had our steel helmets and backpacks and hot water bottle, 40 hours ration, rifles, bayonets, ammunition, and that was it. And I remember lying on the ground, beautiful night, of course, blue sky, stars, and as often had happened before in the desert, one's teeth were chattering with the cold. Now, this often happened in the desert, and where we were now was not nearly as hot as it was in the desert. And I made a mental note on these occasions that I would never believe myself, unless I did make this mental note, that at night my teeth would chatter lying out in the open, and in daytime, 15 minutes after the sun was up, I would be so hot it wasn't true. An incredible experience, and absolutely true. Anyhow, there we lay, teeth chattering from cold, nothing else, waiting for first light. First light came, artillery opened up on the German positions. The Germans were in the foothills and the mountains that were overlooking the flat area and Wadi Akarit. The Argyles went forward to make the bridgehead. Our task was to go through the Argyles, that is the 7th Battalion Black Watch, and extend the bridgehead. It was unclear at one particular stage if the Argyle, or how successful the Argyles had been in creating this bridgehead. So after our advance started, we were under fire from, I think it was 75mm captured French guns, but I never thought much of these guns. After our attack had started, I was sent forward to liaise with the Argyles. So I went forward through the gap that had been made in the anti-tank ditch. There was a lot of shelling going on that gap, as you can imagine now, into the Argyle position, where I met Colonel Lorne Campbell. And they had created a good bridgehead and were developing it, so they seemed to be successful. But the reason I mention this is that Lorne Campbell was given the VC for this engagement. And he was a tall, upright Argyle, and a charming person, absolutely charming. And he then had a flesh neck in his wound, so rather like a kerchief. He had this blood-stained bandage round his neck. Very cheerful, full of confidence that they had created the bridgehead and they would hold on. So I went back to the battalion and reported that the position had been taken by the Argylls and that they were able to hold on. So then our part of the plan was put into operation. Incidentally, it was essential that this position was taken so that the New Zealanders could go through. But I think I'd mentioned that, but it was absolutely essential. So we then went through the Argyll bridgehead, and we went forward over this very flat plain. I suppose it must have been an advance of 300 or 400 yards to the German positions at the foot of the foothills. The artillery the Germans were putting down now was absolutely fantastic, and the firing from both our front and our right flank, we were being enfiladed because the guards were still trying to expand their bridgehead on our right, was quite astonishing. But we ultimately we went over a lot of Italian positions, and the Italians came out in droves, and as the German artillery homed in on us more, then it was, we were getting amongst the Italian positions. It was obviously hitting on the Italian position. Well, they didn't like that much, so the first thing they could think of doing was to get the hell out of it. But there were so many of them, and we had so few troops, we couldn't send anybody back with them. So we just pointed to the anti-tank ditch and told them to avanti or something. We got to the bottom of the foothills. It was extremely difficult and hard to dig in, but fortunately there were a lot of trenches that the Germans had now evacuated. And the Italians had left. And there we dug in a position. Corporal Salmon, the next corporal of mine, I remember, was very badly wounded and killed there. And we had to wait there while the artillery barrage moved forward onto the German positions, but we were rather out on a limb, and the Germans counterattacked, and we lost quite a number of men, and then the Germans brought up tanks. Now we had no tanks. There had been a squadron of tanks which was to come up with us, but they were unable to get over the anti-tank ditch in time, so we were without tank support. We had no mobile support at all. The German counterattack was partially successful, and we had to withdraw. And the position by this time was getting a bit hairy. So wireless back for reinforcements. It was kind of late in the afternoon by now. And incidentally, as this was happening, suddenly John Hopwood, whom I mentioned before, appeared to our right rear in a jeep, driving it across what you might call shell-raked countryside. Followed by a couple of tanks. He had managed to find out where two of the tanks were and was trying to bring them forward, but the trouble is they didn't come forward far enough. But I was then instructed to go back to bring up the 1st Battalion Black Watch, because we urgently needed reinforcements. I remember getting up for the ground and running like mad towards this anti-tank ditch, and there was a machine gunner that seemed to just follow me behind. I could hear the bullets falling. I tripped and fell, I knew I wasn't hip, but I've often wondered if the chaps there watching me run thought I'd been hit. But I got up and managed to get through. As I passed through part of the minefield, there were two wounded jocks lying there. And they were in a pretty bad way. And I knew my first job was to go back and bring up reinforcements, but I suppose this happens to many people. You don't know what to say. You kind of end up saying, well, get somebody to come and pick you up as soon as possible. So I got back to the area where the 1st Battalion were awaited, on our side of the anti-tank ditch. And I must confess, I had never felt so, I don't know if terrified's the word. I was exhausted. I was afraid. In all my life, I remember saying, I'm not going to go back in there. I was absolutely shattered when I found myself saying that. Anyhow, the sum and substance is that I obviously did go back. I got the first company of the 1st Battalion Black Watch and led them back to our battalion position. And with that reinforcement, we were able to re-establish the line and go forward again. When it became dark, we withdrew to make a smaller bridgehead so that the area of ground we had to defend was less. And the strange thing was that were still pockets of Germans that we had not rooted out, as it were, from this bridgehead area. And we discovered this when some wounded were going back to the regimental aid post, and they were attacked by these Germans. So it was a hairy night. We couldn't dig in because the ground was so hard, and we were more or less lying on top of the ground, wondering what was going to happen in the morning when the Germans could observe our position. And there were these patrols. We eventually managed to mop them up, but there were stray Germans here and there. When the dawn came, we were thankful to discover that the pressure that we had put on the enemy, and also that the 4th Indian Division, who had attacked on the night of the 5th on the Jebel Romana position, that the pressure that they had put on the German position had made the Germans decide to withdraw. And they withdrew, and the next position where we met them was a place called Infidaville, which was in the kind of very north of Tunisia. The pursuit was taken over from us by the New Zealanders, that's right, and they pursued the Germans to Infidaville. Infidaville, one should mention that we were then, I suppose we had a delightful few days, if you can call it such, by the sea after this Battle of Accaret. And we were able to swim in the sea. Of course, you got these moments of rest and sheer delight, even in the midst of, or not in the midst of, but in between the operations in which you were engaged. Infidaville was